The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. I see Malcolm Gladwell is standing by for us live from Los Angeles this evening. So a quick introduction. We'll talk not only to him, but also to Dr. Mark Mobius from Franklin Templeton Asset Management about prospects for your South African pension. Also to Mark Hayward, who's been sending direct mails to chief executives of South African companies saying if you want social stability in South Africa, you need to pay for it. Plus, Dr. Martin Davies from Accra in Ghana this evening, where he's been trying out bamboo bicycles. All of that tonight on The Money Show. But first, today's Fast Fact with MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. Your Fast Fact question this evening, what sport does the Competition Commission have in its sights? The Competition Commission is investigating a sport. Which sport is that? If you think you know the answer to today's Fast Fact, let me know on our SMS lines 31702 31567, or you can tweet me on @BruceBusiness.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
I can't believe I'm actually punting my first guest. His podcast is regularly more listened to in South Africa than the Money Show podcast, and that makes me quite grumpy. But he is Malcolm Gladwell. He will be at the BCX Disrupt conference in a couple of weeks. From Tipping Point to Outliers to Blink, David and Goliath, What the Dog Saw, and a recent really, really fantastic podcast series too. He's live on the line to us from Los Angeles this evening. Malcolm Gladwell. And he's gone. As we're about to start, he puts the phone down. Well, he's gone. Tikiso, Lefifi, Anthony, Tony, Kyokopa. There we go. Let's see if we can get him back. Malcolm Gladwell. So after that river, I thought he would have been quite pleased with that introduction. But maybe it's just the telephone lines letting us down. 31702, 31567 if you want to play tonight's Fast Fact game. Of course, Dr. Mark Mobius is standing by for us this evening as well. We'll chat to him on the day that the IMF has downgraded South Africa's growth prospects at the same time as upgrading much of the rest of the world. Does Mark Mobius give a darn about what's happening in South Africa? The fact that he is here suggests that he does, but I wonder just how optimistic he is about our country's future. So we'll talk to him about that in a moment. Malcolm Gladwell, author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, on the line to us from Los Angeles, I hope. Hello, Malcolm.
Yes, hi. Here I am.
Oh, there you are. Thank goodness. You've got a huge following in South Africa. My boss was listening to your McDonald's revisionist history episode, went off and made his own tallow, which is a refined fat for those who don't know. It takes 6 hours just so he could make fries the way Malcolm Gladwell says he should make them. He tells me they're the best chips ever. You seem to be having so much fun talking about exactly what you want to talk about.
I am. This is... Of all things I've done in my career, I think the Revisionist History Podcast is complete freedom. There's no one looking over my shoulder. I'm indulging every one of my pet passions and obsessions. I get to speak out on things I think need my voice. I mean, it's just an extraordinary opportunity.
It's a huge amount of work as well. I mean, you're not pulling any punches on this thing. You seem to be crisscrossing the United States. Certainly the revisionist history episodes I've heard have been US-based. And you're seeing, going face-to-face, you're going into archives, you're doing serious work on this.
Yes, it's so to produce 10 shows, all of which are roughly half an hour long, takes 6 months, and a team of producers and engineers behind me. So it's 6 hard months. I mean, I could take a year if I had a year. It's incredibly intense, but I think it's worth it. And it's this opportunity that's been created by the internet to reach people easily all over the world. I mean, I would never have imagined when I began my journalistic career that this is where I would end up.
You're well known for writing in the New Yorker, and then you came out with Tipping Point, and the rest of the books have followed. You're well known as an author. Does revisionist history become a book, or does it stay in this disruptive medium of the podcast?
I think it stays. When I'm writing a book right now, and it's quite separate from my work on revisionist history, I think they're very different, and I think they're appealing to different people in different ways. I mean, now when I talk to people who listen to my podcast, they're listening, you know, in their car on the way to work or on the subway, you know, when they're traveling somewhere. Whereas book, you know, you read a book in the privacy of your own home, or it's a different. And with a podcast, I'm talking. It's a very intimate medium. I'm talking to someone, you know, directly into their ear. I'm whispering in their ear. You know, that allows you to tell stories in different ways. It's much more emotional. It's much more, and also it skews younger. You know, I'm reaching 18-year-olds now, who I don't know if I would reach them with my books. So I think of them as very different animals.
What is it that you're working on now? Are you still taking these complex academic thoughts and putting them into this readable prose, which has made you so well known? It's your distillation of these great academic ideas into language that we can all understand that has made you famous. What are you working on now? Tell me.
I'm writing a book about communication, about what does it mean to communicate with someone who you neither know nor trust. And the idea of the book is that we have a set of ideas about communicating with strangers that are wrong, and that tremendously impair our ability to make sense of difficult situations. I'm sort of about halfway through, and it's really fascinating. It's getting me very, very, it goes very, very deep into what exactly happens when you sit down and talk to someone. So it's a lot of fun.
And the world of social media means we are talking more and more. And I mean, every day I talk to people I don't know. And people talk to me thinking that they might know me. But we have such fixed ideas as to what communication entails. And the internet, as you're discovering with revisionist history, is changing that so completely.
Yeah, it is. You know, we have so many different ways of receiving information. And I think the thing we have to understand is that every medium has its own rules. And the mistake is when we apply the rules from one medium to another. You know, newspapers have different implicit rules than podcasts, which have different implicit rules than television, which have different, you know, I could go on. And this is what I'm getting at in in this new book I'm writing, which is we have implicit rules about talking to friends and family, and we use them when we talk to strangers, and that's not appropriate. That when you are talking to someone where you have no kind of baseline of understanding, you need to start with a completely different set of guidelines, of kind of rules of engagement. And that's what I'm trying to describe, to explain in my new book.
I read a great piece on Business Insider about your reading habits, and I looked at one of your reading lists, and I'm sure it's evolved since then. But you have this massively eclectic reading list. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I am reading a book about the Korean War, which is enormously fascinating because it has told me something I did not know, which is that during the Korean War, the U.S. government bombed North Korea in a way that no country in human history has ever been bombed. They basically destroyed every square inch of urban North Korea. And unless you know that, you can't make sense of what is happening now with North Korea and the United States. It completely changed. I was like, oh, the grandson of the guy who was running North Korea in 1950, whose country was completely 100% leveled by the United States, is now aiming a missile at the United States. Right? He remembers that. We may have forgotten it, but he hasn't. And it's history. The reason we read history is to look through events through eyes other than our own. And this is the thing, one of the frustrating things about the United States is that, or any large nation, is that they so rarely look at things through the eyes of others, of smaller players.
He's been challenging the way we think about the world for the last decade and a half, and he's coming to South Africa. Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much. The author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, on the line to us from Los Angeles. He's been challenging the way we think about the world for 15 years, and he continues to do it. And what I love about him is he challenges the way he thinks about the world by opening his mind to new ideas. He's coming to South Africa for the BCX Disrupt Conference in a couple of weeks' time. If you've not got a ticket, him, Will I Am, and other great thinkers of the world as it is today are going to be there.
Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
To be an emerging markets investor, you have to be extraordinarily patient. And I've been testing the patience of my guest this evening, Mark Mobius, the executive chairman of Templeton Emerging Markets Group. Mark, you're still traveling so much around the world, more than half of every year, in your private jet, winging your way from emerging market to emerging market.
Exactly. I'm traveling a lot. By the way, your last guest, I was just on the internet trying to find his site, but when I looked up the site, I couldn't find it. What is it called?
I'm not sure what his website is. I mean, he's very famous. Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes. I have the wrong name then.
Yeah, yeah, you've heard of him, I'm sure. I mean,
I've heard of him.
He's. Right.
I looked up disruptive history or revisionist history, but I couldn't get anything. But anyway, I'll remember that. Michael Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell. Very good. No, he's a legend, is Malcolm Gladwell. He's very good. And revisionist history, it's there. The podcast is there. I've just checked it too. Now listen, you're still maintaining this massively punishing schedule. South Africa is being punished at the moment. 120 billion rands worth of foreign outflows from the JSE last year. So far this year, 90 billion rand of foreign outflows. We're on the verge of a full-blown downgrade. But you always seem to be quite upbeat about South Africa and the promise of great returns.
Yes, I mean, we still have about $500 million in this market, and we're not exiting. You know, the interesting thing is, despite all this bad news, the market is performing very well. And it's an interesting comment on equities in general, because I think what happens is when people feel uncertain and they want to get out, equities would be a haven, because a lot of these companies in South Africa are actually outside of South Africa. I mean, you take, you know, Netscape and a few companies like that are really having most of their earnings outside the country. So by investing in those countries, companies, you can be outside in some ways. But we're both. We're in both those global equities, but in South Africa and also in local. Because in the long term, I think things will turn out okay. The great thing about South Africa is you got a free press and you know what's going on and it's open and you've got reasonable hopes that the judiciary will do the right thing going forward. So I think things are beginning to turn and look better than they appear.
And that's it's a point I try and make to people all the time, is that we are obsessed by this leadership battle for the ANC and by implication, the country. And that's outcome of that is 72 days away. Are we focusing on the wrong thing when we focus on the outcome of a political party leadership election?
Yeah, I think so in some ways. Of course, it's important. There's no question about that. But at the same time, look at local governments. I mean, Cape Town is now controlled by the opposition. I think Pretoria is the same thing, and a few other cities. So this is a sign of what's happening, some significant local changes, which we should pay attention to, and maybe a sign of what's going to happen nationally.
I was just looking at a graph on social media a little while ago, and the graph showing that South Africa's currency is the 10th cheapest in the world right now of the currencies, of course, that are monitored on a daily basis. And that makes South Africa also quite an attractive investment destination if you hold to the thesis that in the longer term, everything will be okay.
That's right. I mean, on a price parity, in fact, I was just making a presentation today and I had a price parity chart, and I think I shows about 34% undervalued against the U.S. dollar. So that's quite a big undervaluation. And if you believe that things are going to get better and there's not going to be restriction on flows, then you're in good shape. The big problem, of course, is that if the government overspends too much and gets short of foreign exchange, then investors will find it difficult to exit. So this is something we have to pay attention to.
Well, you said you've still got $500 million invested in South Africa. At your peak, what was the amount of money you had invested here?
Oh, probably maybe 800, maybe.
Okay, so I mean, say you're down by a third or so from your peak investment in South Africa. That seems like a reasonable position to hold for somebody who remains fairly confident in our future.
Exactly, that's right. And it's a great country, let's face it. There are a lot of good things happening here. And, you know,
There's no sense of exiting whole hog. You know, it doesn't make sense.
Dr. Mark Mabius, thank you. Executive Chairman of Templeton Emerging Markets Group on the line to us from Joburg this evening. And then before that, Malcolm Gladwell, the globally renowned, and now also to Mark Mabius, because now Mark Mabius knows who Malcolm Gladwell is. Oh, yes, I've heard of him. And Malcolm Gladwell is going to be here in a couple of weeks at the BCX Disrupt Summit. Some great guests this evening on The Money Show, with many more to come in the next 15 minutes or so. Why is it that the activist has been writing to the chief executive? Mark Hayward, the Section 27 executive director, has been writing personal letters to CEOs saying, if you want a stable future, pay for it. We'll talk to him about that in 15, 16 minutes' time.
The Money Show.
The markets.
First Gladwell, then Mabius, and now McCurry. This day, Wayne McCurry gets better and better and better. How you doing, Wayne?
Thank you, Bruce. I'm pretty well in yourself, yes.
Another record day. You getting bored yet?
No, look, I mean, the market's been very strong over the last 3 months. We seem to have broken out of the trading range we've been in for three odd years. We'll see how it goes. I mean, surprisingly enough, the biggest negative for the market could be a strong rand, because certainly a lot of this run-up we've seen in the last while has been on the back of weaker rand pushing commodity shares and rand hedge shares. So, but it is good news. You must not detract anything from that.
Mark Mabius from Franklin Templeton, you'll know him, saying that the rand is undervalued by 35% against the US dollar. There's lots of purchasing power parity, the sort of Big Mac index, which would support that sort of thesis, Wayne.
Yeah, look, I mean, 35 will take it down to 10. I think that's maybe being a little bit optimistic. The rand is probably slightly undervalued. But, I mean, who actually knows? These are all very theoretical, these valuation levels for the rand. If we get a positive outcome in December when the ANC conference, it could go there. But unless we get a really positive outcome, you know, I can't be that bullish on the rand. I mean, I don't think the rand's going to collapse in front of our eyes. But to call 10 to the dollars may be a little bit too optimistic.
Okay, Dis-Chem, no bitter pills in Dis-Chem. My goodness me, what a strong trading update.
No, very strong trading update. And certainly the market wasn't expecting this, even though the share was at a fairly high valuation level. And from the look of the trading update, a justifiably high valuation level, because they, despite the economy, despite everything else, they're firing on all cylinders.
They most certainly are, and by firing on all cylinders, there's an assumption that Clix is probably firing on at least one. And when one of these big companies does well, its competitors tend to sort of rise as well. The assumption is everybody's doing well.
Yeah, well, look, maybe it's a bit of a broad assumption, but the market will tend to do that. I mean, a couple of the retailers were quite strong today as well. Mr. Price was up quite nicely. But certainly the Dis-Chem results were fantastic. I mean, I think the share ended up 7%.
I most certainly did. One that didn't do well today, Famous Brands, yesterday, 5:15, it dropped the biggest bomb it's dropped in the last 15 or 16 years. Profits are going to halve, and the share price today reacted appropriately.
It took a beating. I mean, I think it was down 15% at one stage and ended down about 11%. Now, I suppose it's just the magnitude of the problem in the Gourmet Burger Kitchen in the UK, because we all knew about this. We all knew that they're having problems here. And, you know, unfortunately, it just looks as though they've taken too big a bite there. I mean, it's fantastic business strategy to diversify out of rands over time. But what happens with a lot of companies is they go so big with a global acquisition that something goes wrong there. It damages years and years and years of reputation that the company has built up. And the good South African operation gets dwarfed by the bad news from the massive global acquisition. But having said all of that, sometimes things like this create opportunities for you to buy a company, a really fundamentally good company, at a significantly reduced price. I think it's too early yet to buy on Famous Brands, but it could quite easily get to a very, very nice cheap level. I mean, you can take MediClinic, very similar. You know, they've had problems in Dubai, but it's still fundamentally a good company, and now is the time to go and buy it. But as I said, it might be a bit too early on Famous Brands.
Wayne McCurry, Portfolio Manager with Ashburton Investments this evening on The Money Show. Thank you, Wayne McCurry, for joining us tonight. Earlier, today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I asked you, which sport does the Competition Commission have in its sight? My favourite answer comes from Brian. Competition Commission is reviewing rugby as the All Blacks are abusing their dominance. Brian, that has made my evening. It really has. Thanks for that. But it's wrong, I'm afraid. So the Commission's actually referred the South African Football Intermediaries Association, SAIFIA, and 36 of its members to the Competition Tribunal for prosecution in relation to fixing of prices and trading conditions. SAIFIA is a body of sports agents that manages soccer players and coaches, and they negotiate transfer fees. They negotiate contracts on behalf of players and coaches. A commission investigation revealed their standard commissions on club contracts, commercial and sponsorships. They're those standard commissions, and they're not happy about it. If you like that fast fact, then join me for the Brutal Biz Quiz on Friday night, of course, where I will test your ability to master the fast facts. And if you're the whiz of the Biz Quiz, I'll give you 2,000 Rand in cash, because MTN understands the importance of protecting what helps your business grow. They are the ICT provider with end-to-end security solutions to protect your business. Visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. In a couple of minutes' time, we're going to talk to the activist Mark Hayward as to why he is getting into the inboxes of South Africa's most powerful chief executives. That's coming up in a couple of minutes' time. An interesting plan by McKinsey to pay back the billion rand in Eskom fees it earned for consultancy work. It says it'll do so if the courts determine that the power utility acted unlawfully. Now, this is clever, I think, on behalf of McKinsey, although a lot of people are criticizing McKinsey, which is going to be criticized anyway, no matter what it does. But McKinsey's position, and it's been quite strong on this, saying it created value and it did nothing illegal. But Eskom's admission that it might have violated its own procurement regulations could land the consultants in trouble in the US. So McKinsey's covering its bases here. It says it's entered into the contract. It performed its work in good faith. Essentially, it's saying if Eskom broke its own rules, why should it be McKinsey's fault that it did? But McKinsey's got another problem, and that is if it's found to have violated any corruption, international corruption laws, US corruption laws in particular, it's going to find itself in all kinds of bother. So it's covering its bases and saying it'll be up to the courts to decide whether or not it should pay back the money. It has committed to ring fencing that billion rand, and let's see where it goes. On the next Money Show, I'm bringing you our shapeshifter, Solly Kramer. You've seen his name above liquor stores all over town, but this Solly Kramer is chief executive of Norman Goodfellas. You've seen that in Cape Town. You've seen it in Joburg. If you're confused, well, I am too. Well, tune in for the whole story next time on The Money Show, plus Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. That's all coming up on the next Money Show.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
Welcome to The Money Show. I'm sensing there's a lot of annoyance. I'm sensing there's a lot of rage at South African companies. Lucas tearing a strip of Famous Brands, telling them that they don't love their customers nearly enough, and he's happy that Famous Brands' share price has fallen. And then somebody else who doesn't sign his SMS is saying, Dis-Chem can brag, but where are retailers getting all their money? And the implication there is that it comes from you. They're not bragging. They're legally obliged. To disclose where what their level of profits are. It's just the rules of listing. So I'm sorry you think they're bragging. It's just that they're disclosing what they're doing. They run a great business, do Dis-Chem. And yeah, watch that space. I didn't find Mark Mobius convincing, says somebody else. He seems strangely uninformed, unless he was just trying to mouth niceties. I mean, this is a guy who manages $500 million of investors' money in South Africa. And I know that he got the name Naspers wrong. But the guy, I think, must be permanently jet-lagged. He's in his late 70s, if not 80s. Can you just Google his age quickly? I should have done that before the show. But he's got a worldly wise approach to him. I've met him a couple of times, interviewed him a couple of times. I find his perspectives interesting. And then somebody saying, I didn't know that Solly Kramer was still around. I think Solly is the son of Solly. if I'm not wrong on that one. So we're talking to Solly, the son of Solly, about Norman Goodfellas and about South Africa's liquor trade. Mark Mobius, my producer, Tikiso, thank you, tells me he's 81 years old. If you could be half as sharp and bright as Mark Mobius at 81, I'll take it. Thank you very much indeed. Are you one of the more than, I think, 20 executives to receive a personal letter from the Section 21 Executive Director, the activist Mark Hayward, asking for money? Mark Hayward, you've actually written personally to CEOs saying, either if you want a stable society, you better pay for it. I mean, I'm consolidating and maybe misrepresenting you, but that's essentially the point that you're making. Sort of stability in South Africa is not going to come cheap, you're saying.
Good evening, Bruce. First of all, thank you. Yeah, we have written, I have written, in fact, as you said, to 20, more than 20 CEOs and South African business leaders. And I haven't quite put it as crudely as the way you presented it. But what I've said is that you've seen over the last few years how organizations like my organization, which is a Section 21 registered not-for-profit company, are playing a crucial role in our democracy, in challenging corruption, in challenging bad government, in promoting equality. And I'm trying to say that business has as much of an interest in growing equality and a stable society as it does in anti-corruption. So my message, my plea is, will you start to invest in organizations like Section 27, not through your tick-the-box CSI funds, which are usually safe funds, but seeing Section 27 as a way of investing and realizing a public profit. So it's a new concept that I'm trying to get across, and it's a challenge to think differently that we are putting to our country's business leaders.
2 years ago, I would have said you're on a hiding to nothing because big business didn't want to rock the boat. And we had that conversation with Wendy Applebaum and others downstairs in our very swish car park with a live studio audience. And you were grumpy with big business for not supporting Section 27. Have you had a more productive response this time around?
Well, I think there's a great deal more exchange and interaction between big business and parts of civil society like Section 27. There's a lot of discussion about ideas and about the type of society that we want. But there's not really an investment in it yet. You know, my organization, Section 27, gets a lot of its funds from overseas, from international foundations. They are prepared to invest in our democracy and in our constitution. But it doesn't seem as if there's many local investors in our constitution, and that's what's going to have to change. You know, suddenly big business has discovered the value of the public protector and of the courts and of public accountability. I think that discovery needs to be carried forward into an actual commitment, to a greater sense of ownership. And as I said, to this notion that there is a public profit to be made out of investment in social business, that equality is good for business, that as Business Leadership South Africa is now saying, capitalism must be seen to have a human face and not just a self-interest all of the time.
Isn't there a risk that CEO A or CEO K says, okay, here's the 500,000 rand that you're asking for 2 years, go off and do good work. And the next thing, they have a KPMG or a misstep of some description. And then you're kind of obliged to have a go at your sponsors, essentially. Or does this just mean that they have to ensure that the onus is on them to behave even more squeakily than ever before?
Well, I think that's part of the deal. I mean, we don't want any money from any company that is involved in dirty dealings. And at this moment in time, we certainly wouldn't take money from a KPMG or from a McKinsey. You know, this is part of a process. It's part of a process of renewal of business. And what we're saying to business is invest in us, but don't expect any favors. You know, if I ask Discovery Health, for example, and I have written to Adrian Gore, to invest in Section 27. Don't expect that if Section 27 is approached to tackle discoveries, wrongdoing in unfair discrimination in relation to, for example, paying out for patients with cancer, that we're going to shy away from it. What we're trying to say is that an engaged and independent civil society, even if at times it is critical of you, is as good for business as an engaged and independent civil society is good for government, even when it's critical. And government seems, or parts of government, to have come to understand that. But business is lagging behind. It's a mindset change that we are all having to contemplate.
You've written to my chief executive too. I don't own him, you understand.
Correct.
He's not mine. He's the chief executive of the company I represent on this show, which is Prime Media, Roger Jardine. Has he responded?
He hasn't responded yet, but to be fair, I only wrote about 2 days ago to your chief executive, and I do hope that he will respond positively. As I keep trying to say, you don't need to be afraid of organizations like Section 27, because we work within the framework of the Constitution, we use the courts, we abide by the rule of the law and all legal principles. Yes, we may be loud, at times we may be confrontational, but everything that we do, we are doing for the betterment of our society, and in particular for the betterment of the people who are being left out and not being given a slice of the cake. And you, Bruce, know, we all know, that the society we're living in at the moment is not a sustainable or a fair society. And if we don't make the changes, it is going to explode around our ears at some point, and that won't be good
for anybody. Yeah, Mark Hayward, thank you. Executive Director at Section 27. Big business, you have been written to. You've been asked to contribute. Will you contribute? Tommy, in Theresa Park in Pretoria North, your response?
Hi, Bruce. I was just saying to your producer that I recently, a couple of weeks ago, traveled to Mauritius and saw an idea that I think would fit with what Mark is talking about. There, the state collects a certain percentage of the CSI budget of every company into sort of a government kitty, and therefore ensuring that across the board, every company that is got a CSI budget contributes a particular amount into the government kitty. So you have that sort of readily available amount that can be distributed to organizations like Section 27.
Sure.
But here's
the problem. Sorry to interrupt you, Tommy. You are short on time. But here's the problem is, do you trust the government to do it? I mean, if public servants' pensions aren't safe, how is money ever going to go to a Section 27, which is an organization deeply critical of government? But it's a lovely idea in a government that you trust to do the right thing. Could you imagine a government department saying to Section 27, here's your portion of the money that you can use to beat us with? I can't see it happening. It's a lovely idea, but I can't see it happening right now, which is why big business has to do it directly.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
What generation are you from? Are you a baby boomer? Are you Generation X or Y or Z or Z or whatever it's called? And what comes after Z? I get lost in this. Rachel Thompson doesn't, though. She is Insights Director at GFK South Africa. On the line to us from Durban. How are things in Durban this evening, Rachel, before we talk about Generation Z, as the storm passed?
The storm has passed at the moment. But obviously, some people were hit quite badly, so we're just looking at the aftermath, really.
Okay, I mean, yeah, again, people have died and it's been terrible. A lot of damage has been done, and of course, insurance companies are going to be counting the cost along with people who have lost stuff. But let's talk about Generation Z, please, because South Africa's got a young population. It's got a blessing and maybe even a curse if we don't get our economy right, as Mark Hayward from Section 27 just pointed out. Two-thirds of us in South Africa are under the age of 35. 41% are under 21. And it's these 41% who make up this Generation Z, or is it Generation Z, Rachel?
I say Generation Z because that is what we say in South Africa. Around the world, we say Generation Z. From our perspective, we don't just look at the generation from the world perspective, but what we've done is we've looked at what globally has been said about Generation Z, and then we've taken the research and available, and we've kind of looked at it and said, okay, well, what does that mean for South Africans? We've got 41% of our population that sits in this consumer segment. they're not representing, I mean, some of them are representing the purchasing power at the moment, but they also are having a huge impact on what their families are spending in terms of sort of the pester power and the influence. So we've basically taken a look beyond the now to say what's coming in the future. We know that South Africa is changing rapidly. And if we're going to start looking for innovation opportunities that really meet consumer needs, we can't look at the now and we need to look at the future. And in doing so, we need to understand where our youth are at, what's influencing them, and therefore let's start predicting what their future needs are going to be.
How attractive a consumer market is Generation Z in South Africa, considering the education crisis, the unemployment crisis is worst for these guys in this segment? Disposable incomes of the future surely are an issue. Are we going to see disposable incomes rise? Is that what's anticipated?
I hope so, Bruce. When we look into the research and we look into the psyche and the values of this consumer, we can see that they have a very very positive outlook. There's been a lot going on in their lives. So they've been impacted by the changes, the rapid changes and the complexity of the world and the reality. They're facing the reality of unemployment and crime and lawlessness and, you know, the disruption that's happened worldwide. But with that, we see that they've got a different view on the world. They're breaking the rules. They don't want to follow the rules. They want to break the rules, and they are far more enterprising. So finding ways to make things happen in a different way, in their own unique way. They've grown up at a time where their parents have focused on their unique attributes, and they believe that their unique attributes are what they're going to, what's, you know, going to make it. I mean, someone in life.
How's All Gold meant to make sense to, it makes sense to my generation, it may make sense to this generation, will it make as much sense to Generation Z? And I suppose that's the challenge.
Absolutely. So I think really our research papers are call to marketers just to say, you know, don't just look at millennials, don't stop there, but start looking ahead to the influences that are impacting the youth and what their, you know, consequent behavior is. And I think that the main, implication is that brands mustn't hold on to their story anymore. They need to give up control. These consumers are very well educated. There's been a massive increase in education.
Thank you, Rachel Thompson, Insights Director, GFK South Africa. First hour of The Money Show, done and dusted. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros directly after Eyewitness News. We'll go to Accra in Ghana for the Africa Report. And then everything you ever wanted to know about Sappy. That's all coming up in the next hour.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. I got an email probably 6 months ago from somebody who was furious with me, saying, why do you never talk about Sappy? So, well, I haven't for a long time. Sappy went through a very dark and difficult period in its life. And they said, no, you got to do it. And so we've got the science of Sappy coming up. And looking into Sappy and learning more about what it's up to, Steve Binney, the chief executive, he's outside the studio. He's wearing a suit. And I'm looking forward to introducing him to you in the next half hour or so as we do the science of Sappy tonight. And it's astonishing, actually, when you look at some of the stats. Here is a business that does about $5 billion a year in sales. Half of its sales are European sales. A quarter are in North America and Southern Africa. And we know Sappi's a big South African company. Less than a quarter of its group sales come out of sub-Saharan Africa. So this is another South African global success story, and there are just so many of them. I'm looking forward to learning more about it. This isn't a tricky Tuesday number, but it could have been. So help me out here on 31702 31567 just for fun. What statue might require size 879 shoes? There's a statue that, if it had shoes, would need size 879. Andy Rice is looking quizzical, so we'll put that aside for a minute as we go into Heroes and Zeros this evening. Andy Rice, lovely to have you back.
Good evening, Bruce.
Your zero.
Well, my zero lurks at Cape Town Airport. I think you have seen it, and
I may have given it the odd mention. Yes, and these are the billboard ads on the, in the arrivals, domestic arrivals at Cape Town Airport, yeah, which when they were put up probably 2 or 3 months ago, were inspirational, were adventurous, encapsulated a dream for an African continent, which was positive and thoughtful. And now every double entendre in the world can be read into these ads.
They're big and they're dominant. You can't miss them. And Andrew Woodburn actually sent me a couple of shots of the billboards.
Andrew Woodburn, the head of Woodburn Man, the headhunters.
That's the very one, XSAB and others, yes. Anyway, he was struck by the same issue, which is that, you know, what do you do if you suddenly get bad PR and you've got very optimistic and glowing advertisements out there? And I think that they should have done something, because it so quickly pushes your brain into associating these lines. I mean, the two that Andrew sent me, lighting the way for the next revolution.
That's
so easily twisted into corruption, isn't it?
Now, these ads, I think, are meant to talk about power for, yes, Africa, so electrical power, and they show light beams and
what's that organization? Eskom.
Yes, Eskom. Yes. So they provide the power of solutions, creating agility in the evolving landscape of power and utilities.
The way we power our continent is changing. I mean, I'll say it is, but not necessarily for the better.
Yeah, and now when we, and the way the two that we're picking fight with most is lighting the way for the next revolution. Here is KPMG associated with the state capture story, lighting the way to the next revolution. It's not what they mean, but it's what I, as a cynical individual, interpret, and I've doubled over laughing.
The power of perception in marketing communication proven once again.
Yeah, and they really would do themselves a favor to remove these ads.
Yeah, even if they'd literally pasted over them. I mean, the airport's authority, who presumably are the people who have appointed the sales agent for these ad spaces, would be well advised to just offer a freebie. There'd be someone who would snap it up like a shot. And
well, KPMG would be contractually obliged for a period of time to have a billboard,
yes,
up there.
Yes.
They could put a billboard up saying, "Hey, South Africa, we're sorry."
Oh, that's a bit radical, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, they've said sorry in many ways, yeah, but they could just go, "We've let you down, we're sorry." Far more powerful. They could even just put a strip across these ads to say, we've made a mistake.
Inappropriate message, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And they haven't. But the way we power our continent is changing. And again, the association is there. The way we as KPMG manipulate reality is changing the way power happens on this country, on this continent. And it's not what they mean.
I know, but it's...
But it's the way in which you can read a very, what should be an inspiring and an aspirational message into something deeply negative.
Well, in some ways, it actually links into what I want to talk about for the hero as well, Bruce, because it's about things being ready to be triggered in your head in the same way that the KPMG bad message was triggered by the KPMG advertising. And it's all about salience. And salience means basically importance or the extent to which things jump out at you. And that's exactly what the KPMG posters do. They jump out at you and trigger something in your head that's been lurking there. And so it is with many other marketing campaigns. And that one of the things about achieving salience is that sometimes you don't have to invest all that much money in getting there if you use creativity effectively. And this thinking was triggered by an image I was sent in social media, which was a photograph of the back of a bucky in the UK, and it was a construction company called Patel and Singh. So you can guess what part of the world they originate from. And the line on the back was quite simple. It said, "You've tried the cowboys, now try the Indians."
Oh, I wonder if you could get away with that in South Africa.
Well, it might be considered a bit sensitive, but I think it's just it's clever, self-deprecating wit, and I'm very, very comfortable with that. And it made me think about these one-liners that elevate the brand in question to be bubbling away, ready to be triggered by something quite small. There's a billboard on the, or not a billboard, a business sign on the William Nicoll Highway near here, which is for an estate agent called Frankie Bells. Now, I haven't heard of Frankie Bell's. It's not in the Pam Golding kind of league. But they have have two lines, one up on the billboard that says, "No one sells like Frankie Bell's."
And, it's kind of old-fashioned, but catchy and good.
And
yes,
for their rental operation, they say, "We let them faster than we get them," which I think is lovely as well. So for me, I don't know anything about Frankie Bell's, except that if I ever wanted to sell a house, I would probably put them on the list of people I would talk to, because they've achieved salience in my mind.
And it's the salience same. Is a wonderful yeah. thing. Okay, I'm learning about
it. So it's the
salience.
Same with the, I think we've spoken about the BP garage in Dunkeld East before now.
I now follow.
Yeah.
It's the pump oracle or something on social media, the petrol pump oracle. And it's the guys who, every morning, there's a fresh message on a chalkboard
yep.
outside the BP garage, diagonally across the road from the Hyde Park Shopping Centre.
And you know what? There's very little differentiation between fuel companies and their garages. Everything is linked to location. But I would be prepared to bet that if we did the research, we would find that is one of the few petrol stations or fuel stations which has a clear preference in the minds of many motorists because of that small thing, the chalkboard with the witticisms and the mot juste that are there day in, day out.
But salience is both a positive and a negative. It either resonates yes. with your audience or will turn your audience against you if you've done something in the ilk of KPMG to annoy or insult or offend in any way.
Well, there are big debates going in marketing academia circles as to whether salience is in fact one of the most important objectives of a communication campaign. The proponents argue that where it works best is in the supermarket, when you're actually there pushing your trolley and you're going past the cereal aisle and you're wondering whether to have Nutrific or Shreddies or Cocoa Pops. And that's where the role of salience clicks in. It actually looks subconsciously into your brain, says, now which is the one I seem to be most familiar and know best, and it pushes you towards that brand. At this conference I was at last week, there were big debates between the salience camp led by a guy called Byron Sharp and the kind of positioning and creative camp led by Mark Ritson, and the debate was terrific, and neuroscience and all sorts of things creep in. But I like the idea of salience because it empowers the small advertiser, the one line specialist to compete head on with the big guy.
But that's the beauty of it, and it just yeah. if you can encapsulate what it is you do. I mean, my favorite bit of salience was one of those dreadful honeysuckers. And I think it was in the Eastern Cape. It may even have been in Stutterheim. We're number one in the number twos. And it was just yep. absolutely perfect for that particular. If you needed somebody to come and clear out a septic tank, those were the guys you were going to call.
Well, in much the same vein, there was a big truck, one of the pick-it-up type trucks, but it wasn't, it was a different company. And as I went past it, I looked at it on the left and it said, our business is rubbish.
Yes. So good. So good. There's place for clever in
there
the
is,
world.
Yeah.
Andy Rice, always place for clever. Branding and advertising expert. KPMG, sorry, you get the zero. We're not picking on you. It's just that you're making it easy. And then the Bucky. And he calls it a Bucky, even though it was in England. Patel and
Singh.
Patel and Singh. You tried the cowboys, and that's a nice inference to the plumbers who behave like cowboys. Try the Indians, which, again, it's a play on the Western movies, but at the same time, it's a play on where they come from. They're proud of where they come from, and these are the guys who you're going to want in your home to sort out the job that the cowboys did.
The Indian postmaster in the village where my brother lives in Kent, his name is Patel, so he calls himself Postman Patel.
And for anybody who doesn't know why we think that's funny, is because England is obsessed with a cartoon carrier called Postman Pat.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Report brought to you by Export Credit Insurance Corporation, your export risk partner. And it's to... Are you in Accra still, Martin Davies? Because my screen says you're in Cape Town.
Yes, hi Bruce, how are you today?
It sounds like you're in Accra.
I am. I'm rather far away, West Africa, Accra, in Ghana.
Well done. And I hope you're on the back of a bamboo bicycle, because you were tweeting pictures earlier today of bamboo bicycles.
Yeah, I talk about African innovation in West Africa. So these bicycles, I saw they're making these racing editions, mountain bike editions, even kiddies editions made from bamboo, sort of boxed very heavily together, being sold now for in Europe. They've sold, they told me, 3,000 units at €2,500 a pop. Not too bad. And they're looking for an agent in South Africa, albeit at a lower price point. I was pleased to hear.
You're a keen cyclist. Did you have a spin?
Well, I was thinking of it, but I'm not quite sure I have the confidence to take it on a
Kraal road.
Downhill descent, particularly on a Kraal road as well, Bruce, to sort of compound the nervousness there.
Dr. Martin Davies is the Managing Director for Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte Africa. Political stability indicators. I mean, Ghana is increasingly being seen, I think, as probably one of the most stable and predictable political environments for investors on this continent.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's a country that's politically de-risked itself. And arguably, you know, it's very difficult for resource-driven economies to have truly democratic, accountable sort of systems. And Ghana's achieved that. Still, a resource-driven economy, Bruce, as you know. And I think gold and to an extent oil increasingly. But at the same time, it's a well-functioning democracy. It's a good story, particularly for this part of the world.
But is it an economy that is performing to the extent that was thought that would be 5 years ago? My sense is it's lost a little bit of its luster.
Bruce, is coming back. If we think back, 3 years or so, countries like Ghana, arguably maybe Uganda, certainly Mozambique, these are countries that spent the resource windfall before the windfall, effectively. And we saw a result of this, which is mass, the previous government. The new government has been in place now, the incoming government, 9 months. Previous government, popular spending, bloated civil service, roughly imagine 80% of spend of government budget spent on civil service salaries. And ultimately, it's a country that, through fiscal mismanagement, required an IMF bailout circa April 2015 to the tune of about $900 million. It's been in the last sort of two and a half years or so, a period of fiscal austerity, IMF imposed, and that's a good thing, to try and get its fiscal house in order. We're seeing the country sort of bottomed out. And what amazes me this week, Bruce, is I've been in town a few days and to speak to senior business people, met a couple of ministers, including yesterday evening the Minister of Trade and Industry, and just the incredible confidence in the country. And I think that after 2.5-3 years of really tough times, this country's going to bounce back very quickly.
We talk about Rwanda being this jewel of Africa, but you seem to be pointing towards Ghana making a bit of a comeback.
Well, this is exactly the conversation itself with the Minister also of Business Development, Ibrahim Awal, and the conversation was, I said, listen, we talk about ease of doing business in Africa, countries that are certainly pro-business, creating, you know, effective states, i.e. efficiency in government, cutting out that corruption dramatically, particularly Rwanda. But we always talk about Rwanda, and then we kind of get stuck to think of another example. And we need to see 5, 6, 7, maybe a dozen or so Rwanda-type economies emerge across these 54 countries of Africa. So we have the sense of, you know, increasing competition for capital and also talent, of course, and IP and the like. So what we're seeing now, I think Ghana can certainly, Nigeria is still in sort of structural austerity or structural reform mode. Cote d'Ivoire, of course, it's doing very well, but it's francophone. Ghana's got a great opportunity. It needs to step up to the plate now and really sort of seize that status of the region, something West Africa surprisingly doesn't really have.
Well, what is its big opportunity? I mean, we keep talking about these places with promising business opportunities as South Africa inspires hope or whatever our payoff line is. Yet we constantly fail to see countries on this continent exercise that great advantage that they might have.
So, right. And jokingly say, you know, the strategy often is we never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And I think it's certainly the case in many countries around this neighborhood. It comes down to, but I'm hearing for the first time in Ghana, I first came here about a decade or so ago, and first time really I'm hearing government such a positive rhetoric, strong business confidence, and providing we can just create that government efficiency in the system. You know, it's all about implementation ultimately. And I think it's, we were talking last night, there's 9 initiatives being launched by the government. So 8 initiatives in the last 9 months, and 4 already been implemented. So it's a government that really is pro-business, albeit still somewhat too large, perhaps, and bureaucratic. But, you know, Ghana needs to create that sort of welcoming of the capital and have that, what we call economic agility. The politics, as you started off on, the politics is right. And let's get the economics right. And I think the place can really sort of do very well. Again, providing 25 million people, not too big. It's effectively Lagos, that's the population of Ghana. Nigeria is significantly bigger, but I don't think it's the biggest economy that do and always should win.
Yeah, and also, I mean, a lot of, when you look at these banana skins reports and all these consultants' reports about the state of the world and the way in which the world should and shouldn't work, and one of the key concerns of chief executives is too much regulation. But in countries where there's no regulation, things fall apart, and Ghana's regulatory framework seemed to be pretty solid.
It's there, but again, it comes down to implementation of the Ghana Investment Promotion Centre, the GIPC. It's sort of like the investment promotion agency here in town. And again, it comes across somewhat bureaucratic, and you know the people are trying, but when you've had a very overbearing government in previous administrations, it's very hard for states to step out of the economy, and I think Ghana needs to do that. It comes down to strong leadership and ultimately get the job done. Business needs that sort of, you know, less regulation. You don't legislate to increase efficiency. Often you de-legislate, if that's a word to use. And I think, you know, it's the jury's out here. It starts off very positive last 9 months. I mean, I'll be back here again next year, and we'll see how things are progressing. But Ghana certainly is, and again, arguably, and slightly provocatively, is when your economic competitive advantage often resides in the, you know, the lack of competitive advantage of your neighbours, and Ghana certainly has that. So
What are you hoping to achieve, Martin, in Ghana this week? Is it sort of a fact finding mission to better advise clients, or what is it?
We brought a whole, as Deloitte, we brought a whole group of clients up here, about a dozen of leading South African corporates and clients and the like, and doing a bit of a roadshow, key meetings with government ministers, CEOs, business figures and the like, looking for investment opportunities and really trying to suss out where the ins are in the Ghanaian market. But it's not just Ghana, but maybe from a regional perspective as well. So that's why we're in town, and very much welcomed. And it's good to be back in Ghana.
Well, Dr. Martin Davies, have a go on one of those bicycles. Post a picture. I want to see you on one. Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa, Deloitte. He's got a great Twitter feed, and he goes across this continent, goes into these fabulous places, and really gives you a sense and a feel of what it's like. I'm walking down the road, and I've seen this beautiful building. Click, and takes a photograph and posts a picture. But the bamboo bicycles have blown my mind. They look very solid. They look very well done. And if bamboo's got a bit more give than steel, you've got to imagine it's got a slightly more comfy ride as well. I did ask you at the top of the half hour before Andy Rice, what statue takes a size 879 shoe? Assuming, of course, that the statue wore shoes. I think the Statue of Liberty would wear a sandal. That would be my sense of it. But if the Statue of Liberty wore shoes, the Statue of Liberty would wear, Taryn Daniels, would wear a size 879 shoe. You're absolutely right. I don't know how long it took you to figure that out. I thought some of you might go for the Statue of Christ the Redeemer in Rio de Janeiro. That size shoe, it wouldn't fit anyway. And if it did fit, would you wear it, I wonder? But yeah, that's an interesting one. So the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor would wear a size 879 shoe.
The Money Show.
The Science of.
So as I was doing my preparation for tonight's feature, I went around the building, and I, you know, those packs of paper next to the photocopier. Tiki, so what paper do we use? No, we don't use Sappi paper. We use Mondi paper. That's because Sappi doesn't give us a good deal. But we've got the Sappi chief executive, Steve Binney, in studio with us this evening. And I'm embarrassed to say, I went to go and check, and I'm afraid it's the enemy's paper.
Oh, so good evening, Bruce. I'm sorry to hear that. We'll need to see what deal we can put together.
I think you need to do a deal. 15 years ago, Sappi was meant to be dead by now, wasn't it? I mean, Sappi, one of the biggest producers of glossy paper for the magazine industry, for Vogue, and it's this particular type of beautiful, thick paper that when you lick the tip of your finger and you flick the page, you just feel money and quality as you turn the page. Those magazines were all going to be dead by now and would take Sappi down the toilet with them, because everybody would be reading Vogue on a computer or a tablet. And it hasn't happened to nearly the extent that we thought it might 15 years ago.
Yeah, Bruce, that's right. If you go back some 15 years ago, CEPI went on a very aggressive expansion globally, focused predominantly in the high-end graphic paper that you refer to. At the time, that was a business that was generating good margins and, in fact, was growing at a fairly decent pace. Unfortunately, the world changed. In the mid-2000s, we saw smartphones, the iPad coming along, and then quickly followed by the global financial crisis in 2008. So, unfortunately, CEPI's traditional business went into decline.
But CEPI nearly died.
Look, it faced tremendous pressure at the time. As it went on its global expansion, it incurred a lot of debt. The balance sheet was highly geared, and the business became vulnerable. And what we had to do from sort of 2008, 2009 onwards, and this slightly before I joined, but we had to reflect on where we were as a business, and we've been going through a process over the last 5 or 6 years of repositioning away from the traditional graphic paper towards new growth opportunities.
And the paper businesses, I mean, I mentioned Mondi a little while ago. Mondi is one of South Africa's great success stories as a South African-based global export. And your 75% of your sales are outside of South Africa. Well, 77%, because only 23% are domestic.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And again, if you reflect back some 15, 20 years ago, Mondi also made some strategic decisions. They predominantly focused on packaging. CEPI predominantly focused on graphic paper that you referred to. With the benefit of hindsight, it looks like they made a wonderful decision. But I don't think anybody could quite have predicted at the time how smartphones and iPads would have changed our lives. Nevertheless, we had to be realistic about where we were as a business. And as I say, over the last few years, we have been repositioning, reducing our dependency on graphic paper and looking for new opportunities.
I mean, my understanding of the paper industry comes from Richard Scarry. And you can pick the, I mean, are you familiar with the great work of Richard Scarry? And there you can imagine the scene of there's a hill with lots of trees on it, and there's a beaver with a chainsaw cutting down a tree. It goes onto a logging truck driven by another beaver, perhaps, and goes down to a paper mill that has a river running past it. And there's mulch produced, and then a roll of newsprint comes out the other side. That's the Richard Scarry version of paper production, but that's at its most basic sense. Paper production is?
Well, look, it's changed substantially. I mean, obviously, in the early days, it was predominantly focused on paper, like newsprint and tissue paper and so on. But as the business has evolved over the years, the opportunity to use wood fiber for new opportunities.
I want to talk about nanotechnologies, yes, in just a bit, because that is, it's the materials that not even you guys have conceived of yet that are possible from wood pulp. When we look at the source of your raw materials, because we're doing the science of CEPI this evening, and if you've got any questions for Steve Binney, the Chief Executive Officer of CEPI, which has got a customer base across more than 150 countries, it is a truly global South African company. 64% of its business is still from printing paper, from making paper. Packaging and speciality paper, 16%. And then the wood pulp and paper pulp, I suppose, which you supply to other industries, makes up 19% of your sales, or thereabouts. It's a $5 billion a year business in terms of group sales. That was a 2016 number that I've got. It's a substantial global South African business. If you've got any questions, 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Is it a business that is growing, or is it a business that is consolidated to a point where you've just had to take out so much cost from what was a massively expensive operation to run?
Yeah, Bruce, I think we've got to reflect on where we're at as a business. The numbers you quote are correct. However, if you look at...
They come from your website, so
yes,
I hope they
are. Good, good. If you look at our profitability, it tells a different story. And our traditional graphic paper and printing business is now only about a third of our profits. More than half of our profits come from dissolving pulp, which is a raw material that goes into viscose, and I'll talk about a little bit more about that now. And then our paper packaging and specialities business makes up the 16% that you referred to. And now, interestingly, if you go back 5 or 6 years, the percentage related to graphic paper was significantly higher.
Yeah.
We've repositioned it over the years, and now we have a number of growth areas. We've been converting mills in South Africa, in Europe, and in the US away from the traditional business towards these new growth opportunities.
Now, and paper mills are notoriously dirty. I mean, if one drives through the Kruger Park, one can smell, I don't know if the mill is still there, but one could smell it before you could see it. And it was always quite pungent on the side of the road. Was that a paper mill or was it another kind of process?
Yeah, no, that was a paper mill. I think you'll find that things have improved considerably over the years.
Nice.
We're given emission permits, and we have to comply with those, and we're well within those standards.
Is paper by its nature a dirty business?
I think what we've got to do is focus on the future and.
No, answer the question. By its nature, paper is quite a dirty business.
Yeah, but compared to traditional plastic, it is more a more green. A more renewable product, and that's creating opportunities for CEPI. A number of the large FMCG global players are looking to move away from plastics towards paper, and it's creating wonderful opportunities, and that's why we are converting some of our mills.
And those mills are being converted into technologies of the future. Do you own the forests that you produce around the world? Because, I mean, if you're doing 50% of your sales in Europe, do you own tracts of land in Europe where you're planting for generations to come? Because the life cycle of trees is the science of that, if you can take me through it, is fascinating.
Sure. We don't own the forests in the US and Europe. We buy fiber and we buy timber and pulp. But in South Africa, we predominantly own our forests. We own about 400,000 hectares.
Sorry, 400,000 hectares.
Yes.
That's a farm. Amount of land, isn't it?
It is. It's a big
and mostly
amount of land.
Mostly in Mpumalanga?
Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal.
Okay. And good tree growing areas.
Good tree growing areas, and that's what gives us a strategic benefit. In South Africa, you talked earlier, about 25% of our sales comes from South Africa, but more than half of our profits. And the reason why so much of our profits come from South Africa is that we have a very competitive, low-cost business in South Africa because of our ability to grow trees in a cost-efficient manner. Mm. And that's creating opportunities, and that's why we've been making expansions in the country.
What's the life cycle of a tree? Because I'm assuming most of this is pine, right? I mean, that's the most efficient tree to use.
There are hardwood and softwood trees. We use pine, which is softwood, which mainly goes into packaging. Mm-hmm. But hardwood is mainly used for our viscose dissolving pulp business. And the life cycle is about 10 years.
What would a hardwood be?
Eucalyptus.
Okay, so blue gum trees, eucalyptus trees.
Yeah.
Neither of which are indigenous. I mean, do you ever face any sort of pushback from the green movement who say to you, hold on a second, I mean, this is industrial production. This is the feedlot of trees, if you like.
No, we haven't. We haven't faced that. We manage our plantations responsibly. Clearly, we have to get the right environmental permits, the water permits, and so on, and we comply with those, and we manage. We manage our plantations responsibly.
I mean, you would fit into what? Would you get Department of Environment? Where would
forestry.
You, forestry.
Forestry. Yeah.
Are they good?
Yes, they've been very supportive, and they, as I say, they provide us with permits for water usage and so on, and they've been very cooperative and very supportive of our business.
Are you able to grow jobs in this country?
We've been doing that. Directly, the South African business has been growing, and I'll quote a couple of numbers. Last year, we spent about $1.5 billion on capex opportunities. Next year, we're looking to expand that to $2.6 billion. We have a very attractive small grower initiative where we've developed 4,000 small. Farmers, forestry farmers, and they own collectively about 35,000 hectares. And the encouraging aspect of that is that we buy the timber that they produce, and it obviously goes into our manufacturing process. I think we're spending about $350 million a year. So it's creating jobs for small enterprises, and importantly in rural areas.
And it's critical, but I mean, the unfortunate thing about farming timber is the life cycle is so long. You say the 10-year life cycle. If you're going to plant potatoes or maize, you get a crop every year if the rain's been good.
Sure.
With timber, you've got to have a long pipeline of maturing trees coming through every year in order to be sustainable.
Sure, and that's right. Once you're into the cycle, then clearly it generates an annuity income for the guys. We work closely with the small farmers and we develop and we give them support. And as I say, they're now onto that rotational basis and we're spending $350 million a year.
Steve Binney is the chief executive of SAPI. And SAPI makes half of its profits in South Africa, 23% of its sales in South Africa. We're going to talk about the viscose. We're going to talk about the nanotechnologies, the evolution of SAPI from being an old-fashioned producer of magazine paper and newsprint and the stuff that you put into your printer in order to print a few bank statements nowadays, because banks don't post them because still the post office doesn't work. Sorry, Mark Barnes. And that's been good. Remember the days of the paperless office? So I'm still waiting for the paperless office. I think we use a lot more paper as we rustle our paper, Steve Binney and I, as we talk about the science of SAPI this evening. With 5,000 visitors, 100 speakers and 70 exhibitors, Finance Indaba Africa is the annual conference accountants cannot miss. Join your colleagues at the Sandton Convention Centre on the 12th and 13th of October. Register with the words YES702 at financeindaba.co.za. Get the last tickets for free with the words YES702.
The Money Show.
The science of...
So one of your shirts hanging in your cupboard could be made from a tree. And that's the sort of business that SAPI is evolving into. Viscose. I had possibly the ugliest shirt I've ever owned in the 1990s that was made out of viscose. But viscose is, I suppose, increasingly a useful product. Does it compete with cotton?
Yeah, Bruce, that's right. It's a high-end product. It's regarded as a quality product.
The 90s of the last time I heard.
relative to a polyester product. It competes with cotton at the high end of the textile market. Its benefits are it's very soft in the skin, so it's very popular for ladies' wear. It's used for bedding and the like. Its important advantage over cotton is that it is more environmentally friendly than cotton. It consumes less arable land. It uses less water.
Really?
And less chemicals. And if you look at the global supply of cotton over the last few years, it's actually plateaued.
But if you said to me viscose, I would think that it was in the school of crimpoline and other sort of artificial sort of nylon-y products. I was always under the impression that viscose was not a natural product.
No, it is a natural product. It comes from trees, yeah. And as I say, it's very soft on the skin. It's a very breathable product, and as I say, very popular for ladies' wear.
Okay, that's why I don't know it that well. Wandile Sehlobo, you'll know him as the agricultural economist, has posted, thank you, Wandile, this fantastic picture of South Africa's forestry sector, forest plantations, indigenous forest, timber processing mills. And it's so interesting that forest plantations centered around Cape Town and around Knysna. There's a bit around Stutterheim in the Eastern Cape, southern KZN, all the way through lots of forestry plantations, as you said, all the way through KZN and up through Mpumalanga and into Limpopo. And then indigenous forest, and it's quite tragic actually how little indigenous forest there is left, a bit around Zanien and Nelspruit, some in KZN, some around Stutterheim and Knysna, of course, and a bit around PE. But thank you, Wandile, for that great map of South Africa's forestry sector. Nanotechnology, this is where things start getting really interesting, because it starts in the world of digital printing and in manufacturing products of the future that we can't begin to dream about. Suddenly, the nanotechnology that you're using to convert pulp into new materials is very real.
Yeah, that's right. Anything that you use fossilized fuel products for, you can you can use from the timber, and nanocellulose can have it's in its infancy as an industry, but it can have very wide implication uses. Some of the things that we've developed a pilot plant in the Netherlands, and we are working with a number of potential partners to look at where we can use the technology. Some of the examples of the things that we're working with is in the food industry, in cosmetics.
Even medical applications.
And in medical applications.
If memory serves, when I first saw something about nanotechnologies, it was almost in like skin replacements or plaster replacements or something. There were the sorts of gauzes or whatever it was that was being produced by using nanotechnology. Suddenly, and it binds better with skin and can be absorbed by your system. All these sorts of things,
and that's and these are the kind of things that we are exploring with potential partners. As I say, we've developed a pilot plant, and we are working with these potential partners to look at where we can use it in the medical industry and in cosmetics.
What is it? Is it a great sort of James Bond type lab with lots of people in white coats and clipboards staring intently at Bunsen burners bubbling away? What does it look like?
No, not really. If you saw it's not unlike what you would see in a paper mill. It's obviously more high tech than what you would see in a paper mill, but nothing significantly different.
Yeah. Okay, but still, you're operating at the edge of science, of new applications. Yeah. I mean, are you sure that you're not on the hiding to nothing? I mean, what is proven and not proven in the space?
Well, that's why we've developed a pilot plant. We're taking a cautious approach, but we think the opportunities are vast to be able to develop. It's the same on the packaging side. We've recently acquired a business in the UK, a small business, which has developed barrier technology for packaging purposes. And what we're trying to do...
What is a barrier technology for packaging purposes?
Basically, when you buy food products in the grocery, it's traditionally wrapped in plastics. Mm. And the reason is that allows the food to be preserved. With the push for more green products, the FMCG companies are looking for paper-based solutions that can preserve the product for as long. And the business we've acquired in the UK has some very advanced technologies on the barrier front, which hopefully in time will allow us to replace the plastics in a number of food applications.
Are you by nature a patient person?
We one of our values at Sappi is speed, and we realize we have to move fast. This industry is moving fast, and I want the company to move faster.
So the short answer is no.
No.
I get the sense that so much of this is optimistic, long-term planning and trying and experimenting, and you know, I don't know, for every 100 things you try, maybe one or two will work, and that requires capital and requires patience.
Yeah, look, one of our biggest jobs as the management team of Sappi is to figure out where to spend our capital, and there are a lot of exciting opportunities. We are fairly advanced already on the viscose front. As I say, it's already half of our business, and we have wonderful opportunities to expand further. Packaging, we're making good progress. We've made some small acquisitions to build on that business. And then beyond that, the nanocellulose, extracting the sugar from the pulping process, that has significant opportunities to make xylitol, the lignin.
Sorry, xylitol, the fake sugar, well, not the fake sugar, the sweetener.
Well, it's a natural product.
It's a natural product, but it's fake sugar. The sweetener that comes out of sucrose comes from maize. Can come from wood pulp as well.
Yes, that's right. And we
could stir a tree into your tea.
No, it's a wonderful opportunity. It has and the xylitol that we will be able to produce will have less calories and will have equal sweetness.
But will that come? What sort of plants does that come from though? Because that's not going to come from a blue gum tree or a pine tree.
Yes, it will.
What?
Yes.
How?
I mean, it's extracted as part of the pulping process. A tree is effectively made up of three parts. It's the fiber, the sugar, and the lignin.
Sugar in a tree.
And the lignin, which is the glue that binds it all together.
It's extraordinary. I mean, when one looks at the component parts of an animal, for example, and you look at what sort of the Americans throw away, all the brown bits, all the tasty thighs and wings and things like that, and eat only the breast meat. When you look at the component parts of an animal, it's astonishing what can be done. The glue from the hooves of the cows and all of that sort of stuff. There is a life to trees beyond just pulping them up and turning them into magazines.
Yeah, it's very exciting. For example, the glue, it's used as a binder in dog food, in animal food. It's it's used in cement as well. So it has a number of different applications.
The stuff that comes out of trees. Steve Benny, what an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us the story of Sappi, headquartered in Johannesburg, but very much a global business. 75% of its sales, half of its profits from outside of South Africa, mostly European-based, but also with a strong presence in North America too. Steve Benny, the chief executive of Sappi. That's it from The Money Show for this evening. Thanks for listening. Good night.